IB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's nuclear chief says the country is capable of producing up to 9 kilograms of 20% enriched uranium in a month. Tarzanir is in Saudi Arabia for a summit that is expected to see the end of a long-running blockade on the Arab country. Also coming up, the U.S. Capitol mobilizes the National Guard ahead of planned protests by President Trump's supporters in the lead-up to the Congress' affirmation of Biden's election victory. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's nuclear chief says that his country is capable of producing up to 9 kilograms of 20% enriched uranium in a month. Ali Akbar Salehi made the comments one day after Iran produced the first batch of 20% enriched uranium at his Fordo facility. He said in technical terms it took the country only 24 hours to relaunch the process. Salehi said the move is in line with legislation Parliament recently passed in response to sanctions. He said other requirements of the law, including the installation of more advanced centrifuges, will be fulfilled also. Tehran says its decision to resume 20% enrichment is a remedial action following non-compliance by other signatories of the 2015 nuclear deal. Iran says that it will reverse the step after they meet their commitments. The Iranian army has launched a large-scale drill involving different types of domestically made drones. The area of the exercise stretches from Iran's northeastern province of Semnan to the eastern borders. The ground force, the air defense force, the air force, and the navy are taking part in the maneuvers. During the two-day drill, the Iranian army fly hundreds of drones for combat, reconnaissance, and suicide missions, as well as electronic warfare. New unmanned aerial vehicles and related systems are also unveiled and tested. The chairman of Iran's Joint Chief of Staff says such drills show the readiness of the military.
The drone drills of the Islamic Republic of Iran's army, as well as the exercises conducted recently in the Persian Gulf and maneuvers planned for the coming days, all indicate that the Iranian armed forces are fully ready to counter any threats posed against the country's security.
Major General Baghdadi said that Iran does not intend to invade its neighbors. Top commander, however, warned that, quote, fingers are on the trigger to respond to any action taken by the enemy against Iran. Yusuf Jalali has talked with Mahmoud Mousavi. He's the spokesman for the ongoing Iranian military drills and elaborated on the exercises that involved hundreds of drones.
Even though the advancements have been made under tyrannical sanctions, so our alertness to counter any possible threat actually pleases the Iranian nation and the friendly countries in the region, and our enemies must also know that the examples presented in the drills are just part of the capacities that we have put on display. There are higher capacities, and there are also hidden capabilities that will be used in the appropriate time. We continuously monitor the enemies on land, in the sea, and the air by benefiting our equipment. Part of this equipment are these drones, and we have this on our agenda, and we are fully prepared to counter any possible move by the enemies. We have carried out the necessary exercises, and the equipment will be used upon order. The Islamic Republic of Iran is not after invading any country, but as it has been emphasized on various occasions, that we are fully prepared to defend our nation. We will decisively defend our nation and our territory.
Iran says it has produced the first batch of 20% enriched uranium in the presence of IAEA inspectors at the Fordo facility. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says that the measure is a remedial action after years of non-compliance by the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal.
I am announcing today.
It was on May the 8th, 2018, when the U.S. President unilaterally withdrew Washington from the internationally recognized 2015 Iran nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Following the pullout, Donald Trump left no stone unturned to implement his so-called policy of maximum pressure on Tehran. In line with his policy, Trump not only reimposed sanctions on Iran that had been lifted under the agreement, but also came out with several new crippling measures against the Islamic Republic. In May 2019, Iran notified the remaining signatories to the JCPOA that Tehran would roll back some of its commitments under the deal. It cited failure of the signatories to secure the Islamic Republic's interest, in particular in oil and banking sectors, in the face of Washington's pullout and sanctions. But Britain, Germany, and France, known as E3, failed to take any practical measures, even during the coronavirus pandemic, when U.S. sanctions hampered Iran's efforts to purchase medicines and medical equipment. In the wake of Europe's inaction, the Iranian parliament passed a law last month. It called on the government to produce at least 120 kilograms of 20% enriched uranium annually and store it inside the country. In line with the legislation, Iran started the process to enrich uranium to 20% purity at its Fordo nuclear facility on Monday, a move that was confirmed by the International Atomic Energy Agency and carried out under the presence of its inspectors. And hours later, the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran announced that the first batch of 20% uranium was produced. Iran's foreign minister defended the measure, saying it conforms with the JCPOA.
A remedial action conforms fully with paragraph 36 of JCPOA after years of non-compliance by several other JCPOA participants. Our measures are fully reversible upon full compliance by all.
Zarif's assertions was echoed by the former ambassador of Iran to the IAEA, who is currently a senior consultant at the United Nations.
Each member state or each party to NPT could reach to any level that they require for their consumptions that they have. The only obligation is to inform the IAEA to verify their declaration.
Iran has maintained that its steps to reduce its JCPOA commitments are completely and quickly reversible as soon as the U.S. and Europe return to their own commitments under the deal. Now the ball is in the court of Europe and the incoming administration of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden to practically show whether they are determined to salvage the deal.
The Taj ruler Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani has headed to Saudi Arabia to attend the Persian Gulf Arab Summit. Qatari ruler's trip follows a Monday announcement by Kuwait, said that Saudi Arabia will reopen its airspace, as well as land and sea border, with Qatar, after a three-year dispute. The Tuesday GCC summit is expected to see formal agreements towards ending that dispute. The standoff saw Saudi Arabia, along with Bahrain, the UAE, and Egypt, sever diplomatic ties with Qatar. Riyadh also imposed a blockade on Doha. They accused Qatar of supporting terrorism. That was strongly dismissed by Qatar. The Yemeni army has warned Saudi Arabia to end its onslaught on the country as Riyadh pushes ahead with its deadly assaults on its southern border. Earlier, we discussed the issue with the guests in our news review program. Hello, welcome to the news review. The Yemeni army has vowed to hit Saudi targets within 24 hours if the kingdom does not end its aggression against a war-torn nation.
We say that we continue to hit their economic and lively areas. There were several targets in the data bank of our forces that are ready, and our ready forces are ready right now, and say to the next 24 hours to hit any of those areas if they do not stop their aggression against our people.
The Yemeni army spokesman said the country's armed forces are capable of targeting areas deep inside Saudi Arabia with great precision. Yahya Sari said the Yemeni military has become stronger in the face of Riyadh's six-year war. He said that Yemen's army carried out more than 900 operations in 2020, liberating vast areas of the country from aggressors. The official said as a result of these attacks, hundreds of enemy forces were killed and injured. Abdulatif Al-Washali is a correspondent in Sana'a who joins us. We also have Hossein Al-Bukhaiti, activist and political commentator, also joining us from Sana'a. Abdulatif Al-Washali, our correspondent. First, why don't you tell us what the Yemeni army spokesperson said about the situation with the war and, of course, the way that they may be dealing with it when it comes to Saudi Arabia and targeting deep inside the kingdom.
There is an acceleration in the process of development of Yemeni army's capabilities, military capabilities. The Minister of Defense had already warned and threatened Saudi Arabia and whom behind, and he means Israel, of any provocative action in the region, that they will be faced with the violent response, with the dire response. So the capabilities of the Yemeni army are now stronger. They have ballistic missiles, they have winged missiles, they have drones. So the Saudi Arabia and its allies realize that they are in a great danger.
Hossein Al-Bukhaiti, taking a look at this war in the sense of the, at least the American calendar, that has now ended the year 2020 going into 2021. I'm curious as to how Saudi Arabia gauges their gains and their losses, because it's more losses than gains. And who do you think is the decision maker to continue this war?
A Saudi ambassador in Washington and the White House at that time has released a statement supporting this war because the United States actually is using Saudi Arabia as a tool for its policy in the region, and as well for the sales of weapons, which during the war in Yemen has increased like 500% to 600% in some years. That's why I don't think, as some say, that when Biden will come to power that he will stop that, because there is one lobby who is in control of the decision making in the United States, which is Zionist lobby, and I think that the latest statement from the Yahya Sari, he has insisted that Yemen ports will not remain close as the Saudi port and United Arab Emirate port are open. And he has warned Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates, saying that they must understand this warning. And especially he focused on Hudaydah, because in the last few weeks, Saudi-backed forces has violated the truce inside Hudaydah. They have 3 days ago targeted the gate of a wedding, killing three civilians and injuring other cities inside the city of Hudaydah. That's why there's a clear message to Saudi Arabia that any more violation inside Hudaydah, this will result in attacking deep inside Saudi Arabia and any other country like United Arab Emirates. I just want to add that he has mentioned about what he said, there is 10 strategic targets inside those both countries who is actually in this coalition. I believe that the Yemeni army has actually targeted many, many targets, but there are like oil installation in United Arab Emirates, which has not been touched till this time, and as well there are main ports in Saudi Arabia, like the port of Ras Tanura in the Persian Gulf, which export 85% to 90% of Saudi oil production. That's why I think this is a clear message to Saudi Arabia that Yemeni still have, as Yahya Sari said, new equipment to bring into this battle, and new unit which will be sent to the battle. And I believe that this year, 2021, will be the year of huge attacks against Saudi oil infrastructure and other infrastructure in the Red Sea.
In 1 minute, what do you make of the move of Israel and its submarine, I believe, to come into the Bab el-Mandab Strait? What is the message there?
I think it was clear from the beginning that Israel is interested in the war on Yemen, and they have supported openly. And I think the latest move, it came after United Arab Emirates and other countries normalized their ties with Saudi Arabia. And this latest move it shows the interest of United of Israel, especially in Bab al-Mandab Strait. But I don't think that this actually will have any effect in the war in Yemen, because United Kingdom, United States, and as well Israel, they are well involved in this war from the beginning of, it.
Thank you very much, Hossein Abouqaiti, activist and political commentator. Abdellatif Al-Bashali, thank you, a correspondent there from Sana'a. And that does it for our news review. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back. The U.S. Capitol has mobilized the National Guard ahead of protests by supporters of President Donald Trump. The protests are planned for Tuesday and Wednesday. They coincide with a Congress meeting to certify Joe Biden's victory in the November presidential election. President Trump has repeatedly encouraged this week's protests in Washington, D.C. He's also retweeted a promotion for the rally with a message that he will be there. D.C. police have issued a warning that carrying any sort of firearm is illegal. On Monday, the leader of violent far-right group, the Proud Boys, was arrested and charged with the destruction of property related to a previous pro-Trump rally. U.S. President Donald Trump, meanwhile, has repeated his claims that he won the presidential election, including the race in the southern state of Georgia.
There's no way we lost Georgia. There's no way. That was a rigged election, but we're still fighting it, and you'll see what's going to happen. We'll talk about it. You know, I've had two elections. I won both of them. It's amazing. And I actually did much better on the second one.
During a rally in Georgia, Trump said that President-elect Joe Biden is not taking the White House. Trump said that he's going to, quote, fight like hell to remain in power. Georgia is a state where the outgoing president pushed officials to find votes for him. Trump's Democratic rival Biden won both electoral and popular votes in the November 3rd election. Congress is due to certify the Electoral College votes this Wednesday before Biden takes office on January 20. But Trump keeps refusing to concede defeat. Most Asian markets reversed early Tuesday losses, which were triggered by a sharp drop on Wall Street the previous day. Hong Kong Stock Exchange, which was the hardest hit, rebounded into the green zone. It's partially due to an announcement that three state-owned Chinese companies would stay on Wall Street. The trio had been earmarked to be delisted on the market. There were also gains in Shanghai, Sydney, and Seoul, although Tokyo, among others, remained in the red. On Monday, all three main indices on Wall Street fell more than 1%. That happened amid uncertainty over key Senate runoffs in the U.S. state of Georgia and more lockdowns caused by coronavirus surge. Professor of Economics Steve Keen says the drops in markets in Asia and elsewhere could be short-term as governments pump money into exchanges to keep them afloat.
Financial markets are being held aloft largely by government action. What we call quantitative easing has underwritten the American market dramatically. And of course, it's been tried in Japan, Europe as well. Not yet in many Asian countries, but Australia's talking of doing it. And what it involves is the Federal Reserve using its limitless capacity to create money, to buy bonds off financial institutions, which encourages them to use that cash, which doesn't earn any income, to buy shares instead. And that's why we've had what we call the K-shaped recovery. This is going to continue regardless of who becomes the president of America, whether the rightful person or Donald Trump, as he fantasizes. So I think this is just a short-term disturbance. The markets will continue rising, not because they should, but because they're being pumped up by Federal Reserve and other central bank supports. What we've got is dramatically overvalued markets already. When you look at what's called the Shiller CAPE Index, which adjusts with the volatility of the market is more overvalued than in any time in its history apart from 1929 and 2000. Again, as I said, the volume of money that the Federal Reserve is pumping into the markets is so extreme, of the order of $3 trillion during COVID so far, that it overwhelms people taking money off the table as they're doing right now. The Fed will dive right back in and try to rescue the market. The Fed is more concerned about rescuing the parasite, being the financial markets, than it is rescuing the host, which is the real economy.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani is a champion of the Iranian nation and of the Islamic Ummah. This is the part of a speech delivered on December 16, 2020, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials of Shahid Soleimani commemoration anniversary and with the family members of that great martyr.
Secondly, you should not trust the enemy. This is my definitive word of advice. You should not trust the enemy. You should not trust this and that's promises with the purpose of smoothing the path of resolving the people's problems and of building the future of the country. This is addressed to the officials. Such promises are not made by good people. They are made by bad and malicious people, and not even one out of 100 promises made by such individuals will be honored. You should not forget the enmities. They showed enmity towards us. You witnessed what Trump's and Obama's America did to you. Of course, their enmity is not confined to Trump, so much so that now that he is not there, we say that their enmity is over. This is not the case. Obama's U.S. behaved in a nasty way towards you too. They were mean towards the Iranian nation. The same is true of the three European countries. These three European countries showed absolute disloyalty, and they showed their mean, two-faced, and hypocritical face to the Iranian nation. This is the second piece of advice.
Your light and love, policy, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
The third piece of advice is that you should preserve national unity. Our country needs unity, the Iranian nation's unity. On many matters, the Iranian nation has a unanimous voice and a unanimous demand. However, officials can destroy this. It would be quite a feat on the part of our officials to shatter to pieces this unanimity and to destroy the nation. The officials of the country should do something to reinforce this unity.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Tensions between Iran and the United States have mounted in recent days ahead of the assassination anniversary of the Iranian top general Qasem Soleimani. But the two sides were at loggerheads for quite some time. In December, the U.S. President Donald Trump accused Iran of playing a role in a series of rocket attacks that targeted the U.S. embassy in the Iraqi capital Baghdad, threatening retaliation. During his 4 years in office, Trump has time and again signaled intentions to launch an attack on Iran. Just last November, after being heavily defeated in the presidential election, Trump was reportedly asking senior advisors about potential options for attacking Iran's main nuclear site. A range of senior advisors dissuaded the outgoing president from moving ahead with a military strike. They warned that a strike against Iran's facilities could easily escalate into a broader conflict in the last weeks of Trump's presidency. Analysts say that Trump could trigger a conflict with Iran to distract from his failing attempts to overturn his election loss and to complicate his successor's plans for the region. They say the U.S. president could be thinking about saddling President-elect Biden with some kind of military operation on his way out the door. Even Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has said that Trump is creating a pretext for war. All this is playing out as Biden prepares to enact his own policies after his January 20 inauguration. Biden, on many occasions, has said that he wants to ease Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran and return to the Iran nuclear deal. These are all the steps that hawks in the Trump administration vehemently oppose. Over the past couple of weeks, the U.S. military has beefed up its presence in the region. In mid-December, a U.S. Navy-guided missile submarine made an unusual transit of the Strait of Hormuz, the strategic waterway between Iran and the Arabian Peninsula. Earlier in December, a pair of B-52 bombers from Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana flew what the military called a presence mission over the Persian Gulf. That flight was repeated a week later, with two B-52s flying nonstop from North Dakota and heading home after cruising over the western side of the Persian Gulf. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, noted that the U.S. increased military presence in West Asia stems from Washington's fear of the consequences of its past acts of mischief in this region. The IRGC commander, Major General Hossein Salami, also vowed harsh retaliation against any aggression targeting the country.
We will respond to any move by the enemy with a harder and reciprocally more resolute blow. This has been proven time and time again. We say the same thing today. We will not spare the enemy and will not leave it alone.
Last week, Iran issued a stern warning to the UN Security Council about the U.S.'s recent provocative moves in the region. In a letter to the Council, Iran's permanent mission to the UN raised the alarm over what it called U.S. warmongering tendencies, adding that Washington must bear the full responsibility of the consequences. The letter also echoed Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif's remarks, who said that Iran does not seek war, but will openly and directly defend its people, security, and vital interests.
On the morning of January the 3rd, 2020, the world woke up to the news that top Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani had been martyred in Baghdad by a U.S. drone strike, killing General Soleimani and his entourage. The assassination came as Lieutenant General Soleimani had arrived in Iraq at the invitation of the Iraqi government as part of his ongoing mission to fight terrorism in the region, terrorism that saw the Daesh group firmly in the sights of the Iranian military hero. The killing of General Soleimani was unlawful, as UN rapporteur Agnes Callamard clearly pointed out in her report following the assassination, suggesting a legal case against the perpetrators was the way forward. With the ultimate decision to perform the strike on the convoy of General Soleimani lying solely at the feet of the US president, it seems that Iran has a clear case against Trump for the charge of a war crime, as there was no justification for the killing, as confirmed in the UN report. However, the fact that the assassination took place and very little has been done on an international scale to condemn the murder, it appears to have given a green light to other nations to take illegal actions against Iran. In particular, the recent example of the killing of Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, with officials stating that there had been strong indications that the Israeli regime had been involved in the attack.
Yes, certainly. There has to be accountability for this violent and illegal assassination of General Soleimani. The United States, of course, has always felt it is above the law. It doesn't have to maintain any kind of respect for international law or human rights. And that is one of the reasons that the Donald Trump administration proceeded with this assassination. However, this sends the wrong message to the world community. If the United States can get away with it, then anyone can get away with it. So this must be pursued in the international courts. It's interesting to see that Iran is doing just that.
Yet as the anniversary approaches and ultimately passes, Iran has clearly stated that it will pursue its legal duty to fight for justice for the assassination of General Soleimani, and the memory of the talented and much respected general will live on forever in the hearts of those seeking to continue his mission of making the region a safer place to live. The humiliating defeat for Donald Trump that saw Joe Biden sweep to a landslide victory is a sign of just how poor the decisions made have been perceived by the people of the US. Yet as the commander-in-chief of the US military, his decision to call the strike on General Soleimani was a decision that severely dented his international reputation. But as his last few days in office approach, US boats in the Persian Gulf have started maneuvers in the region, suggesting that Trump is looking for one last act of power prior to his departure, believing that until now, he's gotten away with his heinous acts. But for Iran, the most wicked act of all has yet to be dealt with. The assassination of General Soleimani has yet to see Iran take revenge for the murder, and is something that Iran has stated cannot be rushed and will happen in a matter of time.
I think we can say that currently Iran is taking action against the United States by pursuing this assassination in the courts. Someone must be held responsible and accountable for the assassination. Iran is going through the proper channels to do so. That is certainly one method that Iran can take to rectify this situation. The United States, on the other hand, if it's going to invade Iran, it's going to happen in the next 19 days, which is the last of Donald Trump's administration. While I don't expect things will improve greatly under a Biden administration, they will certainly improve somewhat, probably to the reinstatement of the JCPOA.
But for Lieutenant General Soleimani, the hero of people from across the region and the rest of the world, his ongoing work is being continued by devoted followers and freedom fighters from Iraq to Syria and Palestine to Yemen, and this continuation will be one of the best forms of revenge. Furthermore, with General Soleimani being a champion of fighting terrorism in the region, as well as resisting the US presence in the area, it seems that the sweetest revenge of all has been the victory over the US-backed Daesh group and the American assets in the region leaving the area, providing a safe, free, and healthy living environment for the people of the region. The Israeli regime has always prided itself on being the home of the latest cyber technology, boasting about its capabilities in both aggressive and defensive cyber warfare. However, it seems that the regime has counted its eggs a little too early, as a sophisticated hack has shown the real side of Israeli cybersecurity. The hack, which appears to have taken place over a period of months, appears to be from a source known as PagerKey, with the hackers deploying a form of highly sophisticated ransomware designed to extract high quantities of information from its target, as well as demanding £100,000 in Bitcoin to stop leaks going public. It seems that the hack targeted a cybersecurity company by the name of Portnox, which itself appears to be a major provider of cybersecurity to multiple Israeli regime offices, including the Israeli aerospace industry, El Al, Bezaq, and Clalit Healthcare, many of which have direct links to the Israeli regime and defense systems. Evidence also suggests that much of the information which is threatening to be leaked contains secret information about various Israeli defense networks and companies, which, although not apparent to what exact details are involved, could see highly classified and sensitive Israeli secrets flooded into the public domain. A spokesman for another Israeli cybersecurity company, Clear Sky, announced that the damage done by the hackers has caused significant damage to the Israeli regime and has pointed the finger of blame at Iran as the origin of the attack, raising the question as to just what right does Israel have to put the onus on Iran after the acts the Israeli regime has committed on the country, including, of course, the famous Stuxnet bug, which targeted Iran's peaceful civilian nuclear program.
Even if Iranians were responsible for this latest cyber attack, and indeed the Israeli press has not ascertained culpability yet, and so it said clearly that it can't determine whether or not Iranians were involved, but even if Iranians were involved in this latest cyber attack, Israel would be in no position to complain about it, having taken the cyber gloves off, if you will, by initiating cyber war directly against Iran in 2009 and 10 with the Stuxnet sabotage cyber campaign. This was a campaign of the United States and Israel under the code name Operation Olympic Games, which was designed to destroy elements of Iran's civilian nuclear energy program.
The finger of blame has been pointed at Iran yet again, this time by the Israeli regime. Yet just earlier this month, the US also pointed towards Iran for a series of hacks that were alleged to have breached US voting procedures and officials, something that Iran denied as nonsense. But it seems that Israel is no stranger to cyber attacks themselves, with others predating the Pay2Key attack. Earlier this year, more than 1,000 Israeli websites were hacked, with images of Tel Aviv in flames, warning Israel that the countdown to destruction had begun, with the Israeli building up a host of enemies due to its hostile actions around the world, from the displacement of people in Palestine to the participation of acts of state-sponsored terrorism. Is it any wonder that Tel Aviv is on the radar of multiple hackers from unknown locations? With such attacks proving that the Israeli regime is both ill-equipped to deal with attacks and too hasty in claiming to be a world leader in security-related issues, has the regime then lost its place at the top of the charts when it comes to cyber and electronic technology?
I believe that this latest hack demonstrates that truly all systems are vulnerable to potential cyber attack. And considering the fact that Israel prides itself so much on its high technology and its cybersecurity, this just proves that even the Israeli cybersecurity can be broken. And so this raises the question, why play with fire, especially when fire will be fought with fire?
There's no doubt that the hack is, and may further yet to prove, a huge embarrassment for the Israeli regime, in particular as the details of the information obtained is yet to be revealed by the hackers and is similar in nature to a recent hack on US bodies, which the US alleged originated from Russia. Yet with allegations flying around, the priority now for the Israeli regime is to hope that the information obtained does not fall into the public domain and further shame the regime that appears to have no shame.
As the coronavirus pandemic continues to surge across the world, many countries have started mass vaccinations in an effort to bring the virus under control. From Europe to Latin America, many nations have imported vaccines in large quantities to help their people get rid of the highly infectious disease. Iran, however, has managed to come up with its own domestically produced COVID-19 vaccine. The country has now begun testing the inoculation on humans after successfully completing the initial steps, including tests on animals and obtaining necessary approvals. The human trial of the vaccine was initiated at the headquarters of executing the order of Imam Khomeini in the capital Tehran on Tuesday. A total of 56 volunteers will gradually receive injections during the first stage. The vaccine, Coviran Barakat, is named after the pharmaceutical group behind its development. The achievement comes as Iranian authorities have been critical of the U.S. for hindering the country's efforts to buy a vaccine from abroad. Many believe the Iranian-made vaccine proves the country's enhanced capabilities despite U.S. sanctions.
Necessity is the mother of invention, they say, and the Iranian people needed a vaccine. The U.S. Maximum pressure campaign denied them access to the vaccines. And so the Iranian people, their scientists, their government, had to go the extra mile to be resilient and develop their own domestic vaccine. It's a remarkable achievement, but it's the kind of thing that is an unintended consequence of campaigns of maximum pressure and hybrid warfare against countries. People will learn to be self-sufficient, to be reliant, and they make new alliances with other countries in the military, economic, and political spheres, and that's exactly what Iran has done.
On Saturday, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani once again lashed out at Washington, saying its wicked activities have caused trouble for Tehran to acquire vaccines. Earlier this month, the head of Iran's central bank also slammed the U.S. administration for its sanctions, which he said have been hampering efforts to purchase the inoculation. Abdel Nasser Hemmati said Iran is prepared to purchase the vaccine through the World Health Organization, but it is unable to transfer the required money due to what he called inhumane U.S. sanctions. Hemmati, however, expressed hope that the vaccine-related transactions will be facilitated through other channels. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal in May 2018. Since then, American officials have targeted every Iranian sector with sanctions ever enforced against any nation. The U.S. economic pressure has prompted the Iranian officials to take a tactical step against such measures. Earlier this month, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, urged officials to focus on neutralizing the sanctions apart from securing their removal. The leader even cautioned against trusting the enemies and warned that U.S. hostilities toward Iran will not end once President Trump leaves office. But from the medical field to the military complex, technology, and a whole host of other fields, Iran has advanced its know-how domestically thanks to the U.S. maximum pressure campaign and sanctions.
Clearly, the U.S. campaign of maximum pressure has not succeeded in overturning the government of the Islamic Republic, and in fact has made it stronger and more resilient. And an unintended consequence of all of this maximum pressure campaign has been to force Iran and other countries under the thumb of the U.S. to become more self-reliant and to seek other trading arrangements, other military arrangements, other political alliances. And the end result is that the U.S. empire is now declining, and it will continue to decline at an ever-accelerating pace.
But the U.S. measures are not bound to sanctions alone. Washington and its allies, namely Israel, have a long history of using other evil tactics to prevent Tehran from its advancements. That includes the assassination of Iranian scientists, with Mohsen Fakhrizadeh being the latest victim of U.S. and Israeli plots. Fakhrizadeh is not the only Iranian scientist assassinated by the American and Israeli agents, and probably will not be the last one.
The U.S. and many of the G20 countries engage in regimes of economic sanctions and programs of hybrid warfare against a number of countries with the point of bringing these countries under their control. The U.S. is an empire, and it uses campaigns of hybrid warfare, which included, for example, the targeted assassinations of General Soleimani and the nuclear scientist Dr. Fakhrizadeh. Includes economic sanctions. It includes continuing attacks in the mainstream media. It includes lawfare initiatives against the government of Iran. And it does all this in the hope of bringing down the Iranian government.
Probably they forget the fact that the advancement of a nation does not depend on one person. Eliminating icons like Fakhrizadeh will, of course, be felt for long, but will not stop Iran from going forward. The U.S. anti-Iran moves also raise questions as who is the United States really targeting by using all possible means to block a country's progress, be it hampering efforts to buy a coronavirus vaccine or anything else.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
وقال
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners, and welcome to IRIB English Radio and another program of For Humanity, where we are discussing Imam Ali al-Sajjad's treatise of rights, and we're speaking about loans and the debt collector and everything related to the creditor. Unfortunately, we are able to understand that there is a bad side of loaning money, where sometimes you might give some money and never get the money back. And this is reality of society, which is exactly why Imam Sajjad is emphasizing on this very point. And we've read a variety of traditions from our imams that speak about the correct mannerism that needs to be used in regard to the approach towards loan. Imam Ali, peace be upon him, he says, "Al-daynu riq, wal-qada'u itq." And it means a loan is a kind of slavery. Riq means being a slave, being a servant. And fulfilling that loan, getting rid of that loan, is a kind of emancipating and freeing yourself. So if you can get a loan and you really, really need to get that loan, you're very desperate, there's nothing that you can do. But in general, it's not a good thing to do. So if you're able to pay it back as well, you should pay it back. And this is exactly why in this segment where Imam Sajjad is speaking about loan in Risalatul Huquq, he says, فَإِن كُنْتَ مُوسِرًا أَوْ فَيْتَهُ. And if you are financially capable, then you need to fulfill that loan and give it back. وَكَفَيْتَهُ. You fulfill it. But here there's another very important, interesting part that Imam Sajjad adds. وَأَغْنَيْتَهُ. أَغْنَيْتَهُ doesn't mean you give them additional money. Doesn't mean that you make them rich, right? It might not even mean anything to do with money, but it means that they have that financial capacity and you might not even be in need of that, but you have the money and you give it back. And you give it back with honor. You give it back with grace. So you shouldn't delay the giving back of money. You shouldn't postpone the giving back of money. Be good because they were good to you. They were nice. They were kind. They lent you some money. You borrowed money. Don't wrong them by delaying it or by, unfortunately, this happens sometimes, denying that they even gave you some money. And this is exactly why the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, "Matlu al-ghani dhulm." And Imam Sajjad mentions this in this particular segment, that the delaying or the postponing of a rich person in their debt that they need to be giving back is a type of dhulm. We're going to go for a short break and we will be back very soon.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome again, dear listeners. And when we speak about loaning money and when we speak about borrowing money, you know, a person might really need to do that renovation. They might really need to get married. They might really need to make that trip. They might really need to buy that medicine. You know, it's not all luxury and it's not all just getting pseudo things that they might not really need. Sometimes, you know, you're desperate and you need the money and someone is there, alhamdulillah, to give you that money. So we should honor it. We should make sure that we are well aware of keeping our words, that we respect our words. وَلَمْ تَرُدْهُ الْمَطَلْ means to delay, to stretch, to postpone. And that's the worst thing that a person can do, because Islam regulated all of this. And Islam prohibited riba. And Islam said that we, in as a society, we are accountable and responsible for what we do and what we say. We are accountable for every word that comes out of our mouth, whatever we utter. And so therefore we need to make sure that we stick to what it is that we say. When matalul الْغَنِي ظُلْم, this kind of ظُلْم means you're transgressing their rights. It means you will be the cause for them not to give any more money to anybody else, even though that other person might be loyal, might be faithful, might be truthful, might really be desperate. But because you didn't give the money back, because you keep on delaying and postponing, you gave them the wrong impression. You allowed them to feel regrets that they even gave you the money in the first place. And this is قَطْعُ الْخَيْرِ. This is the worst thing that a person can do, that you, because of your behavior, you will be a cause for them not to give somebody else anything again. And therefore, you need to be kind, you need to be good, you need to be generous, you need to be graceful to whoever is in debt. So let's say you're not able to pay back. You can't give that particular amount of money. The Quran even mentions that. وَإِن كَانَ ذُو عُسْرَةٍ فَنَظِيرَةٌ إِلَى مَيْسَرَةٍ. If you are in a difficult situation, if you are in a predicament and you are in financial restraint, then allow the people should allow you to pay when you are able to. This is an honorable thing. This is a good thing. This is a positive thing. And this is exactly what our religion teaches us. Because if you don't have that level of compassion and mercy and respect and honor for other people, you're going to, of course, find it very, very difficult. You're not able to fulfill that money. What else are you going to do? You can't take out another loan to pay this loan. So on the other side, when the Imam says, وَإِن كَانَ ذُو عُسْرَةٍ, when the Quran and the Imam follows up on this ayah, وَإِن كَانَ ذُو عُسْرَةٍ فَنَظِيرَةٌ إِلَى مَيْسَرَةٍ, then of course, you need to know when the time is to give back the loan. You might be in pressure and you might not have the money, but at least be nice and be polite in your approach. We will continue on to speak about this important topic in our next program of For Humanity. Until then, please visit us on www.pastoday.com or you're able to email us on englishradio@irib.ir. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صلي يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آله